Okay, so we were talking. Let's take a step back and just realize what we've done so far and where we're up to. We started already a few months ago, and we said we're going to take a look at the life, the time period of Shlomo HaMelech, and we pointed out several times that this is not only the story of a man, but it's the story of a nation in a certain very, very, very unique time in our history. And the primary text that describes this is Malachim Aleph, although we've already looked at Divrei Hayamim and certain other things. But in Sefer Malachim Aleph, this time period of Shlomo's life itself, although the period immediately after Shlomo's life is also very relevant to this story, but the period of Shlomo's life itself takes up 11 prakim. And we pointed out that if you look at these 11 prakim, there's a certain structure that you can see. The first few prakim perhaps can be viewed as an introduction, the transition from David to Shlomo. That would be Perek Aleph and Bet, I believe, roughly speaking. And then we have, basically, if we jump to the end, Perek Yud Aleph, the last chapter, we'll discuss the downfall, if you will, of Shlomo and the nation in his time. The centerpiece, though, so if the first two chapters are some kind of an introduction and the last chapter is some kind of a, it's not exactly a conclusion to the story, but the point I'm trying to make is that chapters 3 through 10 form basically the centerpiece of this entire discussion. And it's those prakim that really present the reign of Shlomo in all of its grandeur and all of its glory. Perek Yud Aleph makes it seem, and we'll talk about this, God willing, in a few weeks when we get there, Perek Yud Aleph makes it seem as though everything was great and suddenly collapsed. And I think it's pretty clear that that's not the way it happened, but both, that's the way the Navi is presenting it to us, but both the seeds of the problems that ultimately caused the downfall we're going to have to find in the earlier parts, and we have to also realize that the downfall probably was not quite as dramatic as it seemed, and the Navi is deliberately presenting the positive with perhaps hints at the negative. We've already seen a few of them, and then the negative. So if we look at this unit that presents basically this entire time period in all of its glory and grandeur, with only hints, if that, at any of the problems that might have existed, those eight prakim or so themselves can be divided into three. Perek Gimel and Dalid and Hey present to us different aspects of the magnificent empire that Shlomo built. Then Prakim, actually part of Hey and Vav and Zayin and Chet, all the way through then, present the discussion of the building of the Beit HaMikdash. And then Prakim Tet and Yud almost continue the discussion of what went on before. And we'll have to talk about whether even there's any chronology there, and whether the events that are in other words, so it's secular descriptions, if you will, of the greatness of Shlomo's empire, followed by the centerpiece, which is this very lengthy section discussing the Beit HaMikdash, followed by additional secular events that took place, and we'll have to see whether there's even any chronology there, or whether this is just a literary device. But certainly, what is coming out of that is that the building of the Beit HaMikdash is presented as the crowning achievement and the centerpiece of Shlomo's time period. And that makes sense. We saw already in David and in his speeches at the end of his own life, he handed over the kingdom to Shlomo and told him, this is your mission. This is the time. And this is what you're going to do. So it certainly makes sense that the Tanakh, you know, presents it to us this way. Why am I pointing this out now? The last two classes we looked at the Beit HaMikdash itself, and we're going to sort of conclude that study today. And today we're not even going to really talk about the Beit HaMikdash anymore, but about the ceremony that dedicated it. But before doing that, I just want to return for a brief moment to something that I mentioned even more briefly and probably didn't give enough attention to, and therefore I just want to call your attention to it. If you take a look at the beginning of Perek Zayin, the beginning of chapter 7, which is smack in the middle of the discussion of the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. And remember, the Navi gives us very, very, very detailed descriptions of the Beit HaMikdash and the size of the structure and all of the materials that it was made out of and all the various vessels that are inside. And again, something we've talked about this already a number of times, that's uncharacteristic for anything other than the Mikdash. It is very characteristic for the other places in Tanakh that the Mikdash or the Mishkan is discussed, but other than that, it's not. And again, I'm pointing out what I said a moment ago, that we have to recognize that the whole story of the Mikdash and the Mishkan is bracketed by all sorts of other non-temple-oriented things about Shlomo's kingdom. The fact that he, you know, the empire that he had and the economic achievements and the political and the military achievements and the administrative structure that he set up, some of which we already talked about and more of which we'll be talking about afterwards, the coming of the Queen of Sheba and all those types of things. And the Mikdash is placed in the middle of that, and again, not necessarily because chronologically that's what happened, but because that's the literary message that the Navi wants to give us, that in the center of everything else that Shlomo did was the Beit HaMikdash. If that is true, then the following point is even more dramatic and more puzzling. Because in Perek Zion, smack in the middle of all of this, so, you know, we could almost put this on the board, maybe I should, you know, if we have this bracketed structure, you know, introduction in the beginning. You know what? Let me do it on the board. Why not? Here, if we go like this. Hello. We go like this. No, well, I had the same problem last week, right?
Yeah.
If we go like this, okay, here's our progression. So we had Perek Aleph and Bet. And this we can call introduction. Transition. Okay. We have here Perek Yud Aleph, which is going to be the downfall of Shlomo, right? And in between we had Gimel through Yud. These Prakim are not exact. There were a few places where you're all aware, I assume, if not, maybe I should point out, that the division of the Tanakh into chapters, when we talk about chapter 1, 2, chapter 11, this is a Christian division. It's not of Jewish origin. The Christian church father who did it knew what he was doing. He knew how to read the Bible and he understood it, and there's logic to what he did, but not always does his logic fit our parshanut. And I'll show you, actually, in today's shiur, a great example of that. But roughly speaking, this is the structure. And we said that this part, this will be, you know, let's call this, here, let's make up a term, Chief Eretz Shlomo, the glory of Shlomo. Okay?
Maybe that's an actual term.
I know. But I don't know if it's related to this.
No, because I'm sorry, my daughter's bat mitzvah is next week. And so I'll tell you. I'm going to incorporate some of what you taught me.
Oh, really?
My name is Tiferet.
Oh, wow. So, where does that phrase come from, Tiferet? It just sort of came to me.
I thought you just made it, because you...
No, I didn't make it up, but I made it up in this context, but it's...
But you spoke in the beginning about the whole glory of Shlomo's reign. I'm thinking that's what he's probably thinking.
I have to do a Google on this or something. Tiferet Shlomo, okay, I'll check it out. The term comes from somewhere. Okay, but b'chol ofen. Okay, but, right? We have these two prakim at the beginning and this at the end. I'd love to see the drasha afterwards.
I will thank you for it.
Right? What was that?
I will quote you. Whatever you need to be.
Oh, shekeno shalom, but I'd love to see what you said. Okay. And then this part we said is now going to be subdivided into three divisions, right? How do we do this? So we said Perek Gimel, Dalid, and part of Hay. First part. All right, Gimel to Hay here. We're going to write secular glory, right? The economic, the political, etc. Then we're going to have Hay to Chet. Is going to be Mikdash. And then we're going to have Tet and Yud, also secular. If that's true, then the subdivision here needs to be subdivided even further. Because smack in the middle of this, we have Perek Zion, Sukim Aleph, through Yud Bet. That discuss, right in the middle of the Mikdash, something that has nothing to do with the Beit HaMikdash. And it's so, it's done so strongly that you might almost not notice it's there. Let's take a look and you'll see what I mean. So, just to get the flow, let's read from Perek Vav, Pasuk Lamed Vav, which is at the end of a lengthy description of the outer structure of the building, but even at Tachatzer HaPnimit, we mentioned last week that that expression, the inner courtyard, might imply that there was also an outer courtyard. I won't go back to that, I'm just pointing out this is the Pasuk I was referring to. Shloshat Turei Gazit, V'tur Krutot Arazim, talks about the types of wood that the courtyard was lined with. And then there's a little bit of a concluding sentence. B'shana ha-revi'it yusad Beit Adonai b'yerach ziv.
What pasuk is that?
That was Pasuk Vav, Perek Vav Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Which is basically just a conclusion of the beginning of that section. It tells us that that was the month, the fourth year of Shlomo's reign, in the second month, which in the time of Shlomo was known as Ziv, we call it Sivan. That's when they started building the building. Uveshana ha'achat esrei b'yerach bul hu ha'chodesh hashmini, in the 11th year, in the month of what we call Cheshvan, bul, kala ha'bayit l'chol dvarav l'chol mishpatav v'yivneu sheva shanim. The process took 7 years. It sounds like we're finished talking about the Beit HaMikdash, but we're not, because if you skip down for a minute to Pasuk Yud Gimel, of that same Perek, Perek Zayin, it continues with the description. First we had a description of the outer structure, the physical building, and now there's a description of all the metalwork and all the kelim and everything else that was done. That takes the rest of Perek Zayin. But in the middle of all that, there's 12 psukim that are just sort of stuck in there that discuss something else entirely. Let's go back to the beginning of Perek Aleph. It says, Perek Zayin, I'm sorry. Ve'et beito bana Shlomo shlosh esrei shana. His own house he constructed, and that took 13 years. Beit HaMikdash he built for 7 years. His own house he built for 13 years. We'll talk about this perhaps a little bit later on. About that pasuk, I guess we can say yesh doshino tole shvach v'yesh doshino tole gnai. Some see this as a positive statement, and some as a negative one. Is it that he spent more time on his own house than he spent on the Beit HaMikdash because that was more important to him, or perhaps the opposite? He was very, very energetic and enthusiastic, and devoted all of his attention to the Beit HaMikdash and his own house. You know, put on the back burner, and when there was time, he focused on that, but put other things in, so however you read that. But the point is, why are we talking about Shlomo's house right now? And it's not just to contrast the amount of time. If that's all it was, if it was sort of a parenthetical statement. It just told us that the building the Mikdash took 7 years, and by the way, when he built his own house, it took 13 years. And if the discussion then immediately continued, perhaps we could just read it in that light. But it now goes and discusses his house, and it discusses a different building as well. Pasuk Bet, Vayiven at Beit Ya'ar HaLevanon. There was a building called Beit Ya'ar HaLevanon, the house of the forest of Lebanon, that Shlomo built. And it's not clear what that term means, but let's just see very briefly what that house looked like. Meya ama orko v'chamishim ama rochbo. Its dimensions were 100 amot by 50 amot. That means it was bigger than the Beit HaMikdash. Massive, massive building. And it goes through, and apparently this house was lined with pillars that were made of cedar wood that were brought from Lebanon. Huge building with four rows of pillars, running down the entire length of the building. And then it discusses the nature of this building. What this building was and even where this building is unclear, and it's a machloket among the commentaries. Because it's some of the commentaries, even the Targum Yonatan, which is an early interpretation, translate this as some sort of a summer home. Like very often kings would build summer palaces, and you have to remember in the days before air conditioning. So if you want to have a place that's comfortable to go in the summer, you'd go up to the mountains, to the country, to the forests, and perhaps there'd be a large building on top of the mountain where the breezes are good, and it would be a comfortable place to sit. So some actually understand that this was not even in Yerushalayim, but in some sort of forest. And the Mitzudat David thinks that maybe it was even all the way up in the north of the country. It's called Beit Yar HaLevanon. So maybe it was in the forests of Lebanon, some of which are actually in territory that was controlled by Shlomo. So maybe it was really in a totally different part of the country, in which case he built himself a palace in Yerushalayim, and he also built himself a summer palace or a vacation home or something like that all the way up in the north. The Ralbag offers a similar interpretation, but I guess it troubles him to think that based on the context here, that this house was so far away. He points out that the term Levanon is understood by Chazal in certain places to be a reference to the Beit HaMikdash, from the word Lavan, whiteness and purity, and therefore he thinks that Yar HaLevanon might be the name for one of the forests around Jerusalem. So it might have been just outside the city, perhaps. But others think, based on the context, that no, this building was actually, it's described in the context of the Beit HaMikdash and the king's palace, which was right next to the Beit HaMikdash, and it might have been right there in the royal compound on or next to the Har HaBayit itself. If so, why is it called Beit Yar HaLevanon? Because it was lined with these wooden pillars that were made out of cedar wood imported from Lebanon, and it looked perhaps like a forest. My friend Rabbi Alex Israel, that I quoted already once or twice, who just put out a book on Sefer Melachim, so he quotes in there Noga Haruveni. Noga Haruveni was an Israeli scholar who devoted his life to studying the flora and fauna of Eretz Yisrael in biblical times. Have you ever been to Neot Kedumim, any of you? He's the founder of Neot Kedumim. So apparently he wrote a number of books on this issue. And apparently in one of his books, he offers a unique theory about the Beit Yar HaLevanon. There's some unusual words here. And apparently he thinks that the house was constructed with these pillars of cedar wood. And based on his reading of some of the obscure terminology that's used here, he thinks that there was also some leafy structures that were placed on these things and mirrors that were aligned in such a way to create an optical illusion that when you went into this building, it looked like you were in an infinite forest, an indoor forest, in which case this was just another part of Shlomo. We saw, and we'll see even more, that Shlomo did a lot of things to try to make Yerushalayim, you know, a wondrous city with exotic animals and, you know, all sorts of magnificent buildings and stuff like that. So perhaps Beit Yar HaLevanon was part of the royal compound, a very impressive building, perhaps even with, you know, in some sort of optical illusion or something like that. You'd enter this building and you'd feel like you were in a forest or something. Perhaps it was used for his own recreation or for hosting important dignitaries or something like that. The question is not what this building, the main question is not what this building is and what it was used for, but why is it discussed here, right? We had three chapters before the Beit HaMikdash and another two after that are going to discuss all these types of things, right? And the exotic animals that Shlomo incorporated and the port city that he built in Eilat and all the countries and all the kings who came to see him and all of the women that he married from all the different countries and the diplomatic alliances that he... All those things. So you could have mentioned Beit Yar HaLevanon along there. And then it also describes the royal palace. And the throne chamber. And that's Pesukim 8, 9, 10, and 11. So the placement of the Beit HaMelech and the Beit Yar HaLevanon here, and not here or here, is puzzling.
Was it just pillars, or were things hung on the pillars?
According to what I read in Rabbi Israel's book, I didn't read Noga Ruveni's book. Right. I read the quote from in Rabbi Israel's book. He. There's a word here.
It's supposed to be the krutot, armor. I think that the armor from Lebanon was hung on the pillars.
No, that is true. That right. He brought later on. It says that right. He brought the. These maginim that he had, and he placed them in the Beit Yar HaLevanon. So this building was certainly some sort of a public, whether it was a monumental, building. Did it have any function other than just some kind of a museum or some kind of or whether it also served a functional purpose, you know, and what exactly is,
I thought it was more functional because the armor supposedly was hung on the pillars, and that armor, I assume, was for... protection?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's decorative. I don't think this is functional armor. These maginim are like, you know, shields in the sense of you know, shields of armor or something like that.
It was more that they were lovely to look at.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean the building had no functional purpose. Yeah. In other words, listen, even today we know, you know, certainly in the ancient world, but today as well, you know, in the United States, right, the president has his White House in Washington, but he's also got Camp David in Maryland, and sometimes, right, in theory that's meant for his own vacation, but, you know, sometimes he'll host foreign dignitaries there. There's a concept of such a thing. You know, Hordus built palaces all over the country, and he had one, the main palace was in Yerushalayim, he had a palace in Yericho, and he had a palace in Herodion, and, you know, so, again, it's unclear what the exact function of this building is, where this building was, but the point is, it was part of the royal, either part of the royal compound in Yerushalayim or an annex to it in some other place that also was meant to, even if it's for Shlomo's own personal use, undoubtedly he would host people there, and or perhaps it wasn't used for any function at all. It was just sort of some kind of a museum or someplace that, you know, people would take people on a tour of to look at this thing we built here or something like that.
So by reading it, we really don't know.
You don't know. But that the real question, though, I mean, that's a question in its own right. What was Beit Yara Levanon? But what I want to just focus on here for a moment, and I don't think we're going to come up with an answer right now. I want to raise the issue, is that there's this very clear structure, and it seems to all be pointing inside, you know, if this wasn't here, I just told you the Beit HaMikdash is the center of everything. But it almost looks like the Beit HaMelech and the Beit Yara Levanon is the center of everything. Now, that's one way to read it, and perhaps there's an implied criticism of Shlomo there, right? And again, maybe that goes back to how you want to interpret the fact that he spent 13 years on his own house and only 7 years on the Beit HaMikdash. Is that a positive thing or is that a negative thing? Or perhaps there's another way to read it. The king's palace. And we talked about this as well. There's an idea that I think you can already find in the Torah, but that Shlomo seems to have believed in very strongly, and that seems to be a lot of what this whole structure is showing us, is that the Torah, and particularly Shlomo's implementation of the Torah's vision, did not try to achieve any sort of what we call today separation of church and state, or division of the religious and the secular into separate spheres. And we mentioned that, you know, many cultures have such a concept, and you can see it even in, you know, the Christian church had this in the Middle Ages very, very clearly. You know, the church, which was arguably, if you study medieval history, the church was arguably the single most, I don't think it's even arguable, the church was the single most powerful force in medieval Europe for at least much of the medieval period. There weren't any real kings to speak of. Feudal lords who had control over small areas of territory, and the Pope who basically had influence over the entire Europe. And yet, the philosophy was that there are certain things that the church doesn't get involved in, and at least in formalities, you know, there was this clear division. There's the secular authorities and there's religious authorities. In some cultures, it's even more dramatic where you, and by the way, even Arayom Hazeh. The Vatican, you know, by definition, you know, defines itself as an independent country, right? It's completely, you know, it happens to be in the middle of Rome, which is the capital of Italy. But formally speaking, it views itself, and I guess the Christian world views it, and I guess Italy respects this because they could easily take it over if they wanted to, and they don't, right? It's sort of extraterritorial. It's its own thing. There's the secular authorities. There's the holy people, and never the twain shall meet, so to speak. And the Torah seems to be saying, and Shlomo HaMelech seems to be trying to dramatize, no, it's exactly the opposite. The Beit HaMelech is built next to the Beit HaMikdash. The Sanhedrin, which is a term from the Mishnah, it's unclear exactly what form the Sanhedrin or what later became the Sanhedrin had in the first Beit HaMikdash, but you'll see in a moment that Shlomo makes reference to this as well, sits right there next to the Beit HaMikdash. When you go to the, and what's the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin is the Supreme Court of the country, and it's also the legislature. It's the parliament and the Supreme Court wrapped up into one. And it sits in the second Beit HaMikdash, at least, in the Beit HaMikdash itself. In the second Beit HaMikdash, there was a room called Lishkat HaGazit. It was one of the side rooms in the Beit HaMikdash. Half of the room was in the Beit HaMikdash and half of it was out, so that those who weren't allowed to enter the Beit HaMikdash could still approach the Sanhedrin. But the symbolism of that the seat of the Sanhedrin is in the Beit HaMikdash, and that it's from there that justice is meant to emanate, and all that is very, very clear. So perhaps what is being dramatized to us here is that Shlomo very much saw that that was what he wanted to do. He built the Beit HaMikdash and he built the royal palace and he built the Beit Ya'ir Levanon, but it wasn't two separate things. It was all part of one grandiose vision that he had. Now again, you can still read that L'Shvach or L'Gnai, and you know, positively or negatively. And what was really the main thing, what was really the secondary thing, so we'll talk about those interpretations. But I think it's highly significant that the Tanakh is presenting it to us this way. That not only would we not take this and put this over here as something else, we have this bracketed by this, but some of this actually shows up in the middle here also, in order to show us, I think, that that's what Shlomo was trying to do. He was trying to create in Yerushalayim the capital of the world, really, which would be the political capital of the world, the cultural and intellectual capital of the world, and the spiritual capital of the world. And the center of it all is the Beit HaMikdash. And his own palace is right next to the Beit HaMikdash. And the Beit Ya'ir Levanon seems to be connected to the Beit HaMikdash. And everything else... So we'll criticize Shlomo when we get to Perek Yud Aleph. Right now we're looking at the positive side. At least that's what he was trying to do. Or at least that's what he believed he was trying to do.
So when it says his own house, it's really not only his own house, but all the surrounding houses.
Of course, the king's palace is not a private residence. It's the center of government, for sure.
Yeah, so that's another reason why it took so long, because it was a lot of.
And remember also, he didn't need a palace. His father David had built a palace, and it wasn't old. It had been built. It had been built less than 50 years ago, but he wanted to build a more elaborate and more, you know. And undoubtedly, David's palace wasn't destroyed. It became one of the other structures in the royal compound. Mm-hmm. You know, the old palace that was used by, I don't know who exactly. Right? Okay. Tov. So with that, let's turn now to Perek Chet. Perek Chet discusses the dedication ceremony of the Beit HaMikdash. And it begins, Az Yakel Shlomo et Zikne Yisrael v'ko Rashi HaMatot נשיאי האבות לבני ישראל אל המלך שלמה ירושלים להעלות את ארון ברית אדוני מאיר דוד היציאו. The first two words are themselves noteworthy. Az Yakel. First of all, the word Az, followed by a word beginning with Yud, is a form that we find in a number of places in the Torah. Az Yashir Moshe, of course, one of the most famous ones. There are many other examples as well. It's a literary device that indicates something dramatic and significant and highly, highly profound that's taking place, right? Az Yashir Moshe uvnei Yisrael es Hashirah Zot means this wasn't just something that happened then and there at that moment in time, but this was Shirat Hayam. This song that they sang there is something that's eternal, something that's meta-historic, a song that we continue to sing in our tefillot every day, etc. We've seen this terminology used once before in Shlomo. We're going to see it again in a somewhat surprising context in Perek Yud Aleph. But we've seen it here in Perek Gimel. In Perek Gimel, we have Perek Gimel Pasuk Pasuk Tedvav, the two women who came to Shlomo for the very unusual court case
with the child.
Right, so it began Az Tavona Shteim Nashim Zonot El HaMelech. There it's a tough Nariyud because it's feminine grammar, but it's the same form, right? And there it's a little bit more surprising than it is here. There it seems to be saying also that this court case that became so famous, Mishpat Shlomo, which, you know, also had something, you know, on the surface it was just a dispute between two very unfortunate people in a very difficult circumstance who needed help. And it became much more than that. It became something that people mentioned thousands of years later, long after these women and their child are long dead and forgotten. The case and how Shlomo solved it, you know, and became the emblem of Shlomo's wisdom, etc. Here, it's very clear what's going on. This is the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. This is not just, this is a truly historic moment. And also the word Yakel. Shlomo gathered the people together. There are a number of words that could have been used there, and perhaps there's an allusion here to Vayakel Moshe. When Moshe Rabbeinu built the Mishkan in the desert, the very same word is used. There it's discussing the beginning of the project, not the conclusion. When he called them together to tell them, this is what we're going to do. Vayakel Moshe. and perhaps also to a mitzvah known as Hakel, right? Where once every 7 years in the Beit HaMikdash, right? On the Chag HaSukkot that follows the Shemitah year, there's a mitzvah for the entire nation to gather men, women, and children in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash and for the king to read the Torah to them, Hakel Ata'am. And the Ramban at least views that ceremony as a reenactment of Ma'amad Har Sinai and the giving of the Torah. So perhaps this is being put into that context as well. He calls all the people together and they're going to bring the Aron, which was in Ir David, which David had brought up to Yerushalayim and had built a special tent for it. And we talked about how he had Levim singing in front of it every day for all this time. Now it was going to be brought from there up to the Har Habayit. The expression up to the Har Habayit is both a spiritual concept and also a physical one. Those who are familiar with Ir David, it is lower than the Har Habayit. The Beit HaMikdash was higher than the rest of the city at this time, so they're literally bringing it up to the Har Habayit to bring it into the Beit HaMikdash. This took place on the seventh month, in the month of Tishrei, which is called Yerech Ha'itanim in that time. And Chag seems to be referenced to Chag HaSukkot. We'll see exactly when it took place at the end. You may recall, those who learned with us last year, that this was one of David's mistakes when he brought the Aron toward Jerusalem. The first time he put it on a wagon, and the second time he realized it has to be carried by the Levim and the Kohanim. So Shlomo didn't make that mistake. And the Aron was brought up from Ir David to the Beit HaMikdash. V'yamelech Shlomo v'chol adat Yisrael hanodim alav ito lifnei Aron mizabchim tzonu v'akar asher lo yisafru v'lo yimanu merov. Along this fairly short journey from Ir David to, we don't know exactly where in Ir David the Aron was, but we're talking only about a few hundred meters, maybe a kilometer, as opposed to the journey that had been made from Kiryat Yarim to Yerushalayim, which was a much longer journey. But there's a direct parallel here. The same way David, if you recall, David, when he brought the Aron to Yerushalayim, it was a very slow procession, and they were constantly offering sacrifices all along the way. So Shlomo does the same thing here in this much shorter trip. He brings sacrifices along the way, and it seems clearly to be a parallel to the ceremony that David instituted then, and perhaps not exactly a parallel, but rather a continuation. This is the final step in the Aron's journey. The Aron that was built by Moshe Rabbeinu in the Midbar, that wandered through the Midbar for 40 years, that was then in Gilgal, and that was then in Shiloh, and that was then captured by the Plishtim, and that was sent back miraculously to Beit Shemesh, and wound up in Kiryat Yarim, and sat there for such a long time, and then that David had brought to Yerushalayim, and stopped along the way, and then continued the final, final culmination of that journey. Because from here, the Aron's never going to leave. It's now going to be brought into its permanent location, installed permanently in Amakom Asher Yivchar Hashem. So Shlomo reenacts or continues the ceremony that David did in bringing the Aron to the to Yerushalayim and to the Beit HaMikdash, and not only the Aron, but Pasuk Dalet, Vayalu et Aron Hashem vi et Ohel Moed ve kol klei hakodesh asher ba'ohel. He brought all of the rest of the items that were in Givon. Perhaps some of the modern commentaries suggested that perhaps he had brought them already to Yerushalayim and in preparation for this from Givon, and now, you know, together all the kelim were being brought, installed into the Beit HaMikdash. Pasuk vav vayaviu hakohanim et aron brit Hashem el mekomo el dvir habayit el kodesh hakodeshim el tachat kanfei hakruvim. Those two large kruvim that we spoke about last time with the wing, they were already there. And that Kohanim brought their own into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and placed it underneath the canopy of the wings of the Kruvim that were set up for it. Ki HaKruvim Porsim Kenafayim El Mekom HaAron. The Kruvim had their wings spread out over the place designed for the Aron.